The guest on the podcast today is Foster Huntington. Super excited about this one. He's an artist of all sorts, an author, filmmaker, animator, and certainly an entrepreneur. And he's a car guy as well. He coined the term van life when he quit his job at Ralph Lauren in 2011, bought a van, lived in it, drove all up and down the West Coast surfing, and rode that wave of Instagram and gained a million followers at the time. He's gone on to do some pretty wild projects, building his house, which is a tree fort in a Douglas fir, or a tree house. He's got his cement skate bowl down below, and he's built a movie studio, and that's what he's doing full-time right now. Super interesting guy, so you guys will enjoy this one. Appreciate you doing this, man, taking the time.
Yeah, of course.
So how's the Lancia?
I sold it.
Did you?
Yeah, I sold it, and I have a 93 Nissan Skyline GTR too, and I just kind of fit better in the GTR, and I sent the GTR to this place called owned by this guy named Tommy F. Yeah. And he does like GTR mechanical restoration. So I sent it to him, and like my bill in parts was like, you know, $35,000. So I was like, do I have the Delta and the GTR? I fit in the GTR better. And it's not like crazy. It's all Nismo parts. So it's like Nismo Turbo. And then Nismo Turbo, like, it has a bunch of upgrades in terms of like, it's like OEM plus, you know, so it's like R34 GTR brakes. What else? So that's like a coil pack from an R35 GTR. So it's a bunch of stuff like that just to make it more reliable. And like for the kind of driving that I like to do going on trips, the Delta is just like, it's like a Canyon Ripper, you know, close ratio, loud. Whereas the GTR, I can just get in and it can just go.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, if you're good to go, we'll just jump right in.
Yeah, I'm good to go.
Yeah, cool. You know, I kind of want to, I guess, start at the beginning because I don't know if a lot of my audience will know who you are. But I guess to really paint the backstory, where did you grow up and what did your childhood look like?
I grew up in and around Portland, Oregon. And as a kid, I spent a ton of time outside and was super into snowboarding and skateboarding and backpacking and camping and stuff like that. So that definitely informed my early years. And then I went to college in Maine. And after that, I moved to New York and worked at Ralph Lauren doing concept design for men's sportswear for a couple of years. And then realized that I didn't really
how did that come about? Like, you don't just, you know, get hired by Ralph Lauren to do concept design, or maybe you do.
I had a photo blog in college. I started taking photos, and a designer that worked at Polo saw that and put me in touch with the head of men's design. And I was like, hey, you should get this guy an internship. So I did that the summer between my junior and senior year and went and interned there. And then they offered me a job. So it's, yeah.
And it was your photo blog? Like, was it just, you know, the style you had or kind of the eye you had that they said,
yeah,
hey, we like what you see?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, I was, you know, taking photos in Maine, taking photos in New England, kind of. And I guess they liked my eye and kind of my perspective. And the way that Ralph Lauren does design, they have a technical design team, which makes up the majority of people, and then they have a concept design team that is just fixated more on concepts. They're not like designing garments. It's just kind of more like general vibe and demeanor. And that's so I didn't have any of this background in design, but they're like, that's fine. So yeah, I did that, and then I kept doing photo projects, and a photo project that I did gained some steam, and I got approached by HarperCollins to turn it into a photo book. And this was in 2011. And Instagram was just kind of starting, and social media was kind of really having its moment. It was before it really had its moment, you know. It was like, it was still kind of like web 2.0, I guess. And I was like, hell yeah, like I'll go kind of leave. I didn't really like clothes enough to make that my, you know, profession forever. And I left to focus on photography, and I thought the best way to do it would be to buy a van and travel around for a while working on this photo book. And so I found a VW Vanagon Synchro on this website called the Samba. And I bought it and flew to Reno and picked it up. And then
wow, so around was it like a dropout moment? Like what was your inspiration to do that? You know, was that something you were already exposed to growing up on the West Coast, that that's a possibility to go live in a van and surf? Or were you like, you know, meeting on the road or something and like really inspired by something like that?
I mean, I definitely read on the road and I don't know, like the Krakauer book and In the Wild and stuff like that, and saw the movie. And it's like, I was very bored with modern conventional life, having a job in an office and doing that all the time and working 60 hours a week for some corporation that ultimately didn't give a fuck about me. And I was like, there's more to life than my 20s just spent in this design room. So I didn't have a whole lot of examples of this. And it wasn't like, you know, that idea is very accepted now, but at the time it's not like that. It's not like the digital nomad was not a thing. It was, you know, and I kind of figured I would like go do that for a year until the money ran out, and then I'd go find a job, but I just want to at least try it for a bit, you know?
Yeah. So to jump back to your first book there, I looked at it a little bit online there. Like you kind of pioneered that loadout shot with that book, you know. Now everyone who's a skier or a climber or bike packer takes that classic quintessential loadout picture before they do something cool.
People had done that style of photography before. I actually got inspiration for that from these photos of these like Vietnam era bombers where they'd have all their munitions laid out in front of them. It's fucking nuts. I forget the name. It's like military photos. It wasn't even like style photos or art photos. It's like the military be like, here's how many bombs we can shove on an F4 Phantom. And I was like, damn, that's so fucking cool. It's all like laid out perfectly. So that's kind of what led me to start doing that style, I guess, like inspired me to be like, oh, these are cool kind of like personal definition, you know, personal take, like kind of, it's like an interview, but just in a photo. So yeah, that kind of led to that project, and it's
right. And for the
morphed into its own thing.
Yeah. For the listeners, it is the Burning House book, right? And it was kind of like grab what four or five items and save.
You would take if your house was burning, kind of the things that are nearest and dearest to yourself, you know?
Right.
So
jumping back, I guess, to the van life, you know, you are, I guess, the pioneer of hashtag van life, and really rode that wave of Instagram, you know, travel photography, inspiring probably a whole ton of people to go buy a van and build it out and live in it, or just straight dirtbag in the back of their van.
Yeah, I mean, when I did it in 20, I started in 2011 and I did it in 2014. And by the time I stopped doing it, and it really got peak popular until like maybe 2016 or 17, you know, or maybe even later. Like COVID, I think, was really the moment for van life. But, you know, for me, I thought it was kind of funny. And I started the hashtag as a joke with my friend, like when it's like, oh, your car breaks down, or you pee in a crystal geyser water jug, like that's van life, you know. It wasn't like this kind of like yoga aspirational thing, at least for me, you know. When I started documenting vans. And I was just, I've always really been into vehicles and cars. So I was just always on the lookout for other people doing the same thing. And when I saw a cool car or a truck or a van or a camper, I would just stop and take photos of it. So.
Right. Yeah, and what got you in? Go ahead.
And that kind of just like spawned and kind of grew into this thing that, you know, way larger than I ever thought it would be. But, and I never had no idea was, I had no idea it was going to shake down like that, but I knew that that was my favorite way to travel. And that I was just shocked that people weren't kind of traveling and documenting it that way. I mean, obviously people were traveling like that, but it wasn't, they weren't kind of documenting it in a way that I thought was interesting.
Right. How did your, you know, I guess not knowing anything about you, but like, how did your parents react to you saying, hey, I'm leaving my, you know, dream job, or what would be a dream job for a lot of people in New York City, and going to dirtbag it?
I mean, my mom wanted me to be a lawyer when I was in college. So I think she was like a little like, oh, damn, I don't know if this is such a good idea for you to do this. But once I kind of explained to her the financial implications of it, it's like, look, Mom, I'm going to be fine. She kind of was, she was like less concerned about it. And then my dad was super supportive of me doing it from day one. He was just like, you thought it was so cool, you know? So they were, they're both pretty supportive, you know, emotionally. And
So the hashtag starts taking off and you're now gaining a huge following on Instagram, you know, whatever, a million followers. And what does that success feel like to you? Because there wasn't really the influencer yet in 2011 kind of thing.
I was super isolated from it, and I still am. Like, I don't, like, live in L.A. or live in New York or some city where that's kind of a thing, you know? And even when I was doing the van stuff, I was, like, in really remote places. You know, I'd be, like, my experience would be, like, I'd be in Baja or, like, super rural wherever, and I'd take a bunch of photos, and I'd get back to service, and I'd post some of them, and I'd be, like, It was like this big disconnect. And I've never really had my social presence, media presence be about like me. It's like I was pre-vlogger, you know? So like I wasn't a vlogger. It was back when you could just kind of like document stuff in an interesting way and I would like garner a following. So it wasn't like as much about the cult of personality than it is now. And so I've been relatively really isolated from it. I mean, it wasn't like this crazy like thing, you know, I mean, people would recognize my car and shit like that, but it wasn't like a normal, I think it's very different than it is now. You know, my experience was very different back then.
For sure. What got you into cars or liking cars or vans or just kind of interested in that stuff? Was it the like snowboarding, like the mountain parking lot type deal?
No. I got into cars pretty much from Gran Turismo.
Okay.
Like Gran Turismo 3, I would say, or 2 or 3. And I was living in Portland in high school and middle school. And there was this guy whose kids went to the same school that I did. My parents drove like piece of shit cars, like old Jeep Cherokees, old Volvos, old pickup trucks, like nothing nice, you know?
Yeah.
But I was always incredibly aware of cars. And I remember, and his name is Larry Vaughn, but he had a Escort Cosworth and a Evo 6 Tommy Mackinnon edition, and I would remember seeing these in the parking lot of my high school, being like, holy shit, like, first of all, how do you have these in the United States? I'm like, this is incredible. And then I like kind of chased him down and hassled him, and he let me go see his car collection one time, and he had a whole collection of Group B cars, so like Escort Cosworth, or sorry, RS 200, Lancia Delta S4, Popu Turbo 16, Sport Quattro. He has a Porsche 959, like the craziest car collection you've ever imagined. And he bought them all new in the 80s. He was like, these are cool cars. I'm going to buy them all new. So he bought them all new. And, you know, he bought a fucking Porsche 959 for, you know, 200 grand. And he bought an Audi Sport Quattro for like 80 grand from Audi and picked it up in Germany. Yeah. So that was kind of like, and I was like, you know, maybe 14, 15 when I started like, really, and that's kind of like, those cars kind of really spurred my interest in cars. And I was never really into like, you know, I've never really been into like exotic cars with the exception of maybe like a Porsche 959, you know, but in terms of like, I'm never given a shit about Lamborghinis or McLarens or anything like that. I've always been into more kind of like been into G-Wagons or Land Cruisers or, you know, Integrales or, you know, GTR, stuff like that, where it's like kind of more like, oh yeah, these cars are cool because they played this historic role or they're like, you know, really kind of were important from a technical perspective, you know? So, but then I've also really been into campers and four-wheel drive cars too. So I would say like people normally are like really into one kind of car. Like they're like, I'm a Porsche person, or I'm really into Audis, or I'm really into JDM cars. And I've always been like super eclectic. Like, oh, I had a VW Vanagon that I loved. I have a GTR, R32 GTR that I really like. And, you know, I have an R30 or an E30 Touring that I think is super cool. You know, it's like I have like kind of more a lot of cars like that that I've, and I have a Ford F-350 with a 7.3 turbo diesel that I think is awesome. So it's like kind of all over the place.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it different cars for different uses and different times in life. Like I can totally appreciate that and just what you're into.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, I think it's like, I like the idea of having the right car for the right kind of activity, you know? Like I just bought a Volvo V70R. It's a 2000 with a 6-speed swap. And it's like, I wanted a daily driver that I could take on road trips that was still fun and fast to drive, you know? So there's like, I love kind of like weird cars like that, you know, predominantly like, you know, I think the newest car I own is a 2001. So it's like the cars I like are like, you know, mid 80s to early 2000 kind of deal.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess jumping back to your progression to where you are now, go back to living in the van and you've got this huge Instagram success. And I read that you ran Patagonia's Instagram account for 2 years, like in Instagram's infancy.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And what did that, you know, did that open your eyes to the possibility of what you're doing is commercially viable as far as the social media stuff?
So that came about because I had done a photo project for Urban Outfitters and their creative director had left Urban Outfitters and went to work to Patagonia. And I was pretty much broke after a year living in my car. And I was like, hey man, like why doesn't Patagonia have an Instagram? Like this is bananas. It's such a visual brand. He's like, good question. This was like 2012. They're like, you want to run it? I'm like, sure. And it was kind of as simple as that. And then I would just kind of like go through their archive of historical photos. And I went on some trips. And it was wild because at the start, no one gave a shit about the Instagram. Like no one internally at the company cared at all what I was doing. And then after like a year and a half, it became like this big thing where it was like, it went from being this thing that no one cared about to being like the most public part of the company, you know?
Right.
Or most visible rather. So, and I didn't want to do that. You know, I didn't want to like, I liked having kind of I didn't want to get caught up in the politicalness of like what it is to be like a marketing person for a brand. I just like the idea of like trying to capture and summate what Patagonia is visually. I was interested in that. And so once it kind of like became a thing, I was like, once they're like, you need to like come into work and you need to like be more involved. I'm like, nah, I'm good, dude. Hire someone else to do this, you know? And I guess that this was like 2013 when I quit doing Patagonia social media. I was doing freelance photo stuff, and then like the influencer thing hadn't even happened then. It was like proto influencer shit. You know, I don't think, as far as I can tell, like influence my, I had like a brief stint doing kind of hashtag influencer stuff. And that was from like 2014 to 2016. I would say it's like kind of the heyday of that. And then after that, I just kind of started, I really invested in my production company, Movie Mountain, and started doing stop motion films and making commercials and making short films and stuff like that. So that kind of became the way that I made money. But it was definitely very surreal watching things go from no one cared about it to being like, it was the, that's all marketing people talked about, you know? It's like they no longer give, like when I first started doing shit with Patagonia, all they cared about was their catalog, you know? And now I don't even know if they do a catalog. You know, I haven't kept up on it, you know, but like, that's kind of like the that was like the time of when I was around, you know?
Right. And that ended, you know, by you just saying, hey, this is not what I signed up for. I'm not going to go back to work a corporate marketing job.
Exactly. Like, I don't want to go back and do this again. I've already left. I don't want to get roped back in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you said during that time you did some social media influencing stuff, and that was what, to kind of pay the bills? And
yeah, that was to pay the bills.
It made sense.
Like, yeah. I mean, I did some bike projects for Toyota and Hewlett Packard and I don't know, some other like, you know, Samsung and shit, you know, and just like kind of photo lifestyle adjacent stuff. But it always seemed so corny to me because they like wouldn't let you do what you wanted to do. And it was like, it felt like that scene in fucking Wayne's World where they're like the Pepsi and the hot, but the hot, you know, the pizza and everything like that. And I was like, dude, like this is just not how I want to be making a living. I'd rather like make less money and have to work harder, but feel like okay about what I was doing, as opposed to like, yeah, I only use a Hewlett Packard or whatever, you know. It's like when I had my laptop, my back laptop, I just couldn't do it. But the money was so good that I was like, but then I was like, all right, I don't know, this doesn't lead anywhere good. And then I kind of saw the writing on the wall with that shit being cooked, because that's when Instagram went from the chronological Instagram feed to the algorithm. And then they just started anything that was like associated with a brand, they would just suppress it because they would want to get the brands to pay the company to promote it. So it's like Instagram was like, we don't want influencers making money. We want those companies to pay us, you know? And that's like what happened, you know? And I was like, oh, damn. I remember like talking to someone I know who worked at Instagram. And they like kind of like let me in on that. I was like, okay, I guess I'm not going to be an influencer anymore. Like, not only did I not feel good about it, but it's like the party's over. It was sick while it lasted, but it only lasted for me for 10 years. I mean, I think people still do it, but it's like, it's not like what it was during that one time, you know?
Sure, getting actually, you know, paid in relation to your reach there.
Yeah.
Without ad dollars behind it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think maybe I'm misremembering, but maybe I first came across your Instagram page when you started building your treehouse with the skate bowl and the hot tub below it. And it was just so visually appealing what you were doing there. How did that come about? Were you living in your van still at the time? And
yeah,
I was like, hey, I need a house.
Yeah, actually at the time I was living in a Toyota Land Cruiser, or sorry, Toyota Tacoma with a camper on it. And I was like, I was just kind of tired. I was on the road full time for 3 years. And I wanted to start doing more video stuff. And I just kind of saw the writing on the wall with all my friends who were travel photographers who were like 10 years older than I was. But we were still traveling the same amount. And it's like, they had like kids and wives and shit, but like they couldn't spend any time with their family because they were traveling like 9 months a year, you know? So I'd be like, I don't want to do that. I want to like find out there's another way for this to work. And so I wanted to set up a home base and start like making projects that didn't necessarily revolve around traveling all the time. So I had some savings that I'd made from doing photo work, and I built the tree houses, and I'd always wanted a tree house. And like, damn, there's all these things that I love doing, like surfing and skateboarding. But it's like, I'm not going to be able to surf where I live, but I'd like to have a bowl to skateboard, you know, and I'd like to have a place that is, you know, nothing is quite captures the feeling of waking up in your car or your camper in a new beautiful location every day. But waking up in a tree house is pretty freaking sweet. So I was like, all right, I can do that. So that kind of led me to call up one of my best friends from college who was a carpenter and be like, dude, let's build some tree houses this summer. And that's kind of how that happened.
Right. And it seems like, I mean, obviously since the beginning, you've been documenting everything you've been doing, and, you know, you had the first book, and then I don't know if we said on the podcast, but your van stuff, Home Is Where You Park It, led to another book. Mm-hmm. When you were building the tree house, was the intention to do a book on that as well?
Yeah, I kind of figured that I was like, damn, like, this is so cool. Like, it's so cool. Like, I want to build a process and then document it in a way that I think is reminiscent of these old books that I had. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to build it, and like, I'll make a video about it, and I'll take a bunch of photos and do a photo book, you know, like, that will work. The first book I did was with a publisher, and then I did Home Is Where You Park It and self-published that and did a Kickstarter. And then I was like, oh, I'll just do another Kickstarter. And that's kind of how, when you self-publish, it's like, yeah, they'll print way less books, but I'll make more money per book, and I'll be able to have total control over what the book ends up being, you know? So that's kind of like what led me to pursue that way and just like say forego using a traditional publisher on those books, you know? So.
Right. Right. And I don't know anything about Kickstarter, and maybe I'll ask it. I was going to ask it in relation to Puke, but I'll ask it in relation to the book, I guess. How kind of Kickstarter works? Like, are they investing and they're looking for a return, or is it more of like
it's more of like a pre-order thing. I used it like, okay, a pre-order. Like, here's a way to buy a book and pre-order it, or I sold books and stickers and shit like that, merch. Like, here's a way to do that without, you know, and I would just like putting a deposit down, you know? So that's how I used it.
Right. Now, were those books, during that time, were those books commercially successful enough for you to kind of, I guess, sustain your lifestyle and make a decent living? Or were you always kind of looking during that time, what's next?
No, I mean, the books were actually pretty sweet in terms of, they're pretty lucrative.
Right.
I was able to, you know, make a living just selling those photo books, and people would buy them, or like, you know, some company would buy a handful of them, and, you know, stuff like that. So it definitely worked. At the time, and I still think there is a market for that, you know, that you still can make photo books. If you have like kind of an interesting, cohesive idea, you can like make a book out of it. But it has to be like kind of, you know, it has to be something people haven't seen before, you know, which is increasingly difficult to say the least.
Yeah, for sure. So when did the movie stuff start to kind of creep in, or when did you start pursuing that seriously?
Well, I filmed the treehouse build, and with the idea like, hey, I'm going to make a short film, maybe like 10, 15 minute film to accompany the photo book. And that would be kind of like my foray into learning about the filmmaking process. And so that's kind of how I did that. And then I kind of had the idea that I was like, damn, like if I'm going to, I'd like saw behind the curtain was like, oh, like filmmaking, even a documentary is all some form of like capturing an illusion. You know, there's everything isn't like, it's not like, it's like reality TV isn't reality TV, shocker. You know, like filmmaking isn't like documentary filmmaking isn't just fucking fly on the wall filming stuff. So I was like, oh, and I'd kind of seen, I was like, well, what if like everyone acknowledges that nothing is pure documentary filmmaking? Like, what if it's all made up? Like, why not make shit that looks wild and do it like that? I'm like, oh, damn, sure. Like, and I thought the coolest way to do that would be like with stop motion, where everything is miniature and looks crazy and is totally like, there's nothing remotely like plausible about it. You're just like suspending you're suspending belief from the start. So that was kind of like why I got into doing stop motion. And I thought it'd be really cool to be able to make like, you know, some crazy worlds. So that's what led me.
Right. So I guess explain to the layman what stop motion is and what kind of stuff you're doing there.
So stop motion is where you make a miniature. You know, an example would be like some of the Wes Anderson movies like Fantastic Mr. Fox or Nightmare Before Christmas or some of these kind of films like that. And you pretty much just create a miniature scene, and then you, using first force perspective with the stills camera, take a bunch of stills images of a puppet moving and walking, and you string it together, and it looks like, you know, life size, but it's all miniatures. So that's stop motion.
Right. So you've been doing kind of claymation stop motion stuff, and that looks, you know, totally from the outside, that looks insanely time consuming.
Yeah, it takes forever. Like, I've been working on a science fiction movie, like a feature film, and I had the idea for it 4 years ago. 4 years ago, and started working on it. And it's like, you know, we shot a proof of concept. It's just like the whole process, and it's like, you know, it's just making movies takes forever, and making commercials takes a couple months. So it's pretty dang time consuming.
Right. Yeah. I saw your North Face commercial, and it was, cause I was following along with your stuff and I didn't really see any commercial stuff or, you know, like where you were being hired to do this stuff. And then all of a sudden you do the North Face stuff and it's like, oh wow, this is it in practice totally for, you know, TV or for some media.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and then like, you know, I was working on stop motion stuff and doing a few things here and there. And then COVID happened and we got crazy busy because traditional production stopped, but, you know, companies still wanted content and we could keep making stuff. So, you know, I spent COVID making commercials for Nike and Rivian pretty much.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I watched Puke and I really enjoyed that, man. I thought that was great. Was that a little bit before the stop motion stuff? Was that
no? It was kind of
first deal. Yeah,
it was the same time. So we just established that stop motion takes forever to do, and I was just super bored, or not bored, but like frustrated because it's like, damn, this shit moves so slow. And I was like, I want a project that I can really slash my teeth into, that I can get behind and like believe in and do just for fun. And that's how the Puke documentary came about. Well, I was like, I knew Jake. He was owl pelleting. I was like, this is such a crazy thing. You know, this is so strange. And, you know, I was like really interested and
explain what Jake was doing, like explain I guess the premise behind the documentary.
Okay, so Jake is someone I've known since he was 8 years old, and he was collecting barn owl pellets, which are barn owls eat rodents and barf them up, and they make a little pellet that's like fur and bone. So it's like the undigestible part of an animal. And they barf it up, and then you can dissect it to get a perfect version of a skeleton. And the only way to get these is barn owls don't exist in captivity. So the only way to find these, so like science classes buy them. And like
okay.
Elementary, middle school, high school buy these barn owls. And it's like, oh, like we could dissect a frog or you can dissect a barn owl pellet, you know? And that's kind of how, so like these pellets, so these schools buy them from somewhere, and it turns out they buy them from like these wild people that just drive around looking for them in bars and cliffs. And I worked on that project for like a year and a half, 2 years, just traveling around with them, Jake and his friends, and filming them and going on trips. And, you know, because like with the stop motion stuff, it's like, okay, I got a project. Okay, we storyboard the project. Oh, pre-production takes 2 months, like of building stuff. Then we shoot. So like I wouldn't have to be there all the time, even though we were working a bunch. So I would like just take a week here to go on a trip, go on this trip for a weekend, and then kind of come back. So it was like really nice for me to be, and you know, stop motion would be like, you know, it'd be just a totally different process where there's like 20 people working on a project. Whereas like with Puke, it's just me holding a camera, you know?
Yeah, no, it was super raw. Jake is quite the character. It comes through pretty well in that documentary. He's pretty well read. He's, you know, knee deep in the psychedelic lore for sure. You know, you have
yeah.
seen there where he grows his own cactus, I think, and completely extracts mescaline from it all the way, the whole line him down to him snorting it. Did it work?
Yeah. It did work. Yeah.
Yeah. No, pretty interesting, dude. And I assume the schools aren't paying like a whole ton of money for these pellets.
They pay like, you know, you'd be surprised. I mean, like each one of those pellets is worth like $1.25.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So he's doing it.
Yeah.
So when did you build your studio, and what kind of leap for you was that financially and like as a commitment? Like that's a big, you know, big program. Hey, I'm going to go build a movie studio.
Yeah. So I built the studio in 2015, and I pretty much just drained my savings because I was like, okay, I don't want to be an influencer. I don't want to go work at a company doing marketing. And I wanted to like create my own process and build these really special things. And I tried to find a place to do it, but like rent was expensive and everything like that, you know? And that's where I was like, fuck man, I'll just build one here. You know? And like, so that's how we decided, to do that. I was like the general contractor on it. And I actually ended up like hired my friends to be carpenters and yeah, built it here. And then I bought a bunch of old stop motion equipment from eBay and from people like that and kind of retrofitted it to work with stop motion. And yeah, like that's kind of how it came to be.
Yeah, no, very cool. What's the deal? I think I first saw your clay stuff and your first stop motion stuff was the Professor Rabbit. Well, what was the impetus behind that? Whose idea was that?
So the impetus for that was my friend Sarah McDaniel, whose Instagram is Croce, wanted to do a stop motion puppet. She wanted a rabbit, and she wanted to have it say something from a movie. And I was like, oh man, I think it'd be so much cooler if we had it say some of these kind of more philosophical pieces from like Alan Watts or, you know, Carl Sagan. And she was like, rad, let's do it. So we did that right after we did this version. We did the stop motion skateboarding project.
Right. No, it's cool. I've always thought, like, I've always been into podcasts, but pre-podcast, you know, I'd drive around listening to YouTube kind of thing, and I would just hammer, you know, every single one of Terrence McKenna's talks or all of Alan Watts' talks. And I always thought, like, there's got to be a way for someone to revivify these Terrence McKenna talks. I was kind of hoping you'd continue on with that stuff.
Yeah, I would love to. It's just like financially untenable, you know? And that's kind of like what led me away from making a bunch of stuff from Instagram for social media, is it's like there's no way to make that and make money doing in it without it being like partnering with a weed company or making it into a commercial, you know? Because like unlike YouTube does revenue sharing, you know? Instagram, no, they don't do revenue sharing. So, and also like the way the YouTube works is it's like, it works. It's like, oh, the videos need to be 10 minutes long. They need to do this, that, or the other thing. So it's like all these kind of things that made what we were doing so special wouldn't work financially without like, you know, they just wouldn't work financially. So that's why I've kind of been like, oh, damn, like, yeah, I'd spend all this energy making a stop motion video for Instagram. And then it would get reposted by a bunch of meme accounts and it would get all the views on there. And, you know, maybe we get some followers to get them clout, but it's not like there was no like financial. It wasn't like the only way that would work technically would be like if I made money making advertisements and then I just did that shit for fun. But it's like, I don't want to make advertisements. I want to make movies, you know? So that's why for the last few years, I've put more energy into projects like Puke or this sci-fi film I'm doing. Cause it's like, you know, I kind of was like having early success on social media was just like, it's not as cool as you think it is to have like social media clout or whatever, you know? It's like, that's not what it's all about. And I didn't get into taking photography and making videos to get social media clout. I wanted to make stuff that feels like I'm expressing myself, but I also need to make a living doing it, you know? So that's why I've kind of like haven't made more rabbit videos or haven't made more kind of content like that. Cause it's just like, you know, cause it's like, it takes a lot of people to make that stuff. If it was just me, I'd keep doing it, but it's like, no, I got a bunch of people, you know, that I have to pay to do it. So that's why I'm like, well, I want to make a movie. So that's why I've been working on making movies.
Right. So is that your answer to that, that balance of, you know, art versus the, you know, capitalistic world there?
Yeah.
Have to.
Art and commerce.
Yeah. So is movies, is that the answer? You know, is that the most art for art's sake you can get?
I thought that for years, but now I think movie making is done. I think AI is going to like totally fucking destroy. I mean, movies are already kind of done. I mean, everyone watches miniseries and stuff like that. You know, like I think I read the statistic that recently, like movie theaters are showing 30% of the movies that they did pre-pandemic or something like that. Crazy, where it's just like, it just, because all those movies are just going straight to streamers or they're not making them at all. And I think that AI is going to just utterly decimate the movie industry in terms of there'll still be movies made, but they'll just be AI generated, you know? And
right,
like, you, because you'll be able to be like, hey, we want a new Star Wars movie. Here's the last 9 Star Wars movies. Okay, like, here's a script. Boom. And it'll be like, sweet, we got you a movie. Like, we didn't have to pay any actors. We paid actors for their likeness, but we didn't have to. We didn't have to hire camera crews. We didn't have to hire set builders and editors. And here's this thing. You can kind of like fine tune it and finesse it, you know? So I think movies are, I don't know. I don't think it's, but it's, movies aren't what they were when we grew up as kids. It's a totally different thing now. And I think kind of generationally, I'm going to be 35 soon. Generationally, it just didn't line up for me to make movies. I'm trying. I'm like pitching movies right now, but I'm not to be pessimistic. And, you know, the people that like work with me are going to be like, no, Foster, like, you need to say you're making movies. But I'm just like, I don't think our generation is like the creative force of our generation isn't going to go into making movies, because they're not going to hire our generation. They're going to hire like the Gen Xers are going to be able to make movies for the next fucking 50 years, probably, you know? So like, cause like, you know, people like, Paul Thomas Anderson or David Fincher, whoever, it's like those guys are in their 40s now, 50s, modern medicine, those dudes will live until they're 100, you know? Like, Martin Scorsese is in his 80s and still making movies, you know? Same thing with Spielberg, they're in their 80s. So it's like all the people that are still going to be making movies the old way are going to be those guys who have already killed it. So it's like our generation, I'm like, damn, dude, I don't know. I don't think they're going to be like, the analogy I use is like, maybe, I don't know. You're from Canada, right?
Yeah. I'm in close to Toronto.
Yeah. So like in the state at middle school and high school dances, they always used to play Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin. Like that was the
last.
So, like, the analogy I use with filmmaking is, like, Stairway to Heaven just came on. You're a freshman. You're, like, you know, and all the cute girls, they're already dancing with the seniors that were on, like, the fucking hockey team or whatever, you know? Like, they're not, yeah, you're not dancing with any of those girls. You're going to sit there on the sides and, like, watch it go down. That's how I feel, like, with filmmaking is going to happen generationally, you know? So I don't think that movies are it. I think that, or like traditional narrative movies, are it. I still think there's room for documentaries and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm personally being like, damn, dude, I spent the last like 7-8 years of my life trying to like work towards this goal of making movies. And I think it's just like, I couldn't have foreseen how good AI was going to be, you know, like, when I started seeing these AI-generated images this fall, I was like, whoa, okay. Like, I didn't think it would happen this fast. And if they're already making, like, great images, it's like, look at the difference between Gran Turismo 1 and Gran Turismo 3, to use the car analogy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, Gran Turismo 1 was, like, unplayable. Gran Turismo 3, you can still play and have fun today, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I think that's like what we're going to see happen over the next 5 years, 10 years with AI generated stuff, where it's like, unless you're documenting something real, it'd just be brutal, you know?
Right. So documenting something real. So you're pessimistic about your sci-fi stop motion stuff?
No, I think I'm going to be able to sneak this one in before it goes, before the party's over. Like I think I'm going to sneak it in. But in terms of, like, I think in 10 years, it's going to be very different, you know?
Right.
But, like, documentary projects, you know, like the F1 shit on Netflix, like, stuff like that will always be... people will want something that captures real life, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, I mean, you look at how many people are just... the eyeballs are on TikTok or just watching people's lives.
The attention spans are nuked. Yeah, too.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, people want the raw, the raw stuff, you know?
Yeah.
A well-polished video doesn't work on TikTok, and people
nor on YouTube, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there is a hunger for real life, you know, voyeurism from the couch.
Yeah, definitely. That's always going to be there.
Yeah, for sure. So you think you're going to be able to sneak in your stuff?
I bet I'll be able to sneak a movie in.
Okay.
I'm going to try.
And is it because you've kind of taken steps backwards towards the stop motion stuff where it's like, no one's really doing this?
Planning for it. Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to be strategic about it for a while, you know? But I will say that the AI thing is like one of the first times in my life where I've been truly stumped. I've been like, whoa. Like everything else I saw coming. I was like, oh, Instagram, that's Netflix, TikTok. It's like, oh yeah, I get this. The AI was the first time where I was like, holy shit, half my friends are going to lose their job in the next 10 years. Okay. You know, like that's been like a big one for me, being like, whoa. How do I figure that out? But, you know.
Right. As far as, and your friends in kind of filmmaking industry stuff?
Filmmaking,
stuff or friends?
You know, creative, anything kind of remotely creative. Like if your job is to make logos or make decks or come up with ideas for like, you know, a Starbucks commercial or something like that, you know? Like, this guy, these producers that I work with, not to get too in the weed, but these producers that I work with just made this big commercial for a massive software company, like one of the biggest in the world. And they flew around filming all this stuff, and they finished the commercial, and it turns out that ChatGPT wrote the script for the commercial. It was an AI-generated commercial. Like, humans didn't write it. It was just AI had wrote the whole thing. So this thing that used to be a team of 30 people was now done by 2 people, you know? And
right.
That's just the future, unfortunately. So like, and if you're kind of like, the crazy thing is like so many creative people are behind the veil at a company working on stuff, you know? And the reality is like, those people are like, dunzo. You know, like music, like so many people exist in the music industry that are creative, but it's like AI will be able to do that, you know? So it's not to be doom or gloom, but I don't know. My outlook isn't too cheerful on that.
Right. Like, so in your mind, AI is the big one. Cause I mean, anyone who dismisses this argument will use the argument, hey, look back in history, you know, the washing machine, the printing press, all of these things were going to be the end of X, Y, and Z industries.
Yeah, I think it's just going to be
jobs.
No. Yeah, I don't think so. I think this is like totally unparalleled, you know? Yeah.
Where does it lead? Okay. Like I'm sure you've been playing with ChatGPT. Like where do you see this going for, you know, humanity? Like if it takes away the entire industries, what do people do in North America at least?
I think the reality is that the world is going to need way less people. Make of that what you will. You know, like,
yeah.
I don't see how it does it, you know? I think that, like, there's certain, yeah. Like, if your job, let's just put it this way. If during COVID you could work remote, your job probably won't exist in 10 years, you know, for 90% of people, I think, you know. Like, there's an example, there's exceptions, but it's like if you're, like, some kind of working remote, like, doing emails, doing sales, coming up with logos, doing stuff like that, I think those jobs are going to go away. I am fundamentally stooped trying to wrap my head around how an economy will be able to sustain itself when there isn't, like, when you have the same productivity, if not more, but you can do it with 1/10 the people. I don't know how it, I don't know what happened, you know?
Right. I mean, I you know, people are so adaptable. I'm not completely call it black-pilled on the idea, but
yeah.
You know, like there is the return to, you know, people living off the grid, and you see that firsthand, obviously, and you know, people living their own kind of sequestered lives that maybe a step backwards. It may be like Terrence McKenna's archaic revival, you know?
Yeah. It really depends on what your term of progress is. I mean, yeah, I hope I'm wrong. I probably a good chance I will be, but I don't think, I mean, you know, if you look at technology, the evolutions of technology in terms of productivity since the 80s, like the average person hasn't had a raise. All that income from that productivity has gone towards the people that own the businesses. And the only reason that people aren't burning shit and stabbing people with pitchfork is because you can go to Walmart and buy a 50-inch 4K TV for $150 or whatever. You know, like, buying power has got, stayed so cheap that, like, people are like, oh, yeah, my income hasn't gone up in real terms, but my buying power is pretty sick, you know? I can buy you name it, cool whiz-bang thing. But I think at some point there's, like, you know, diminishing returns and a breakdown of that, you know? So I don't know. I mean, this is definitely the first time in my life where I'm like, I guess I'm black-pilled. Maybe I'm just old, dude. Maybe it's like I've reached that point where I'm like too old to get what the future will hold. I hope that's the case. But I think that, you know, like, so far, like, you know, people are saying that 90% of content online is going to be AI generated. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right, you know? So who knows? I feel like you said, I think stuff that isn't AI generated will stand out more because it's like visceral and real, you know? Mm-hmm. But I don't know, dude. It is strange time. Strange time. And I guess, like, another reason why I'm starting to feel like older is like the kind of cars and shit I'm into. It's like, I'm like that guy who's like wanted the car that I wanted in high school, you know, like an E30 M3.
Yeah.
Even though I'm like way older than that, you know, or like an E46 M3. I'm like, damn, that thing is cool. You know, like, I wanted that in high school. But I do think that there is something to be said about those cars because they are the last ones that are like unfucked by technology and infotainment and stuff like that. Hey, what? You know, they are the cars that don't have like crazy, you know, traction control and stuff like that, you know? So I do think...
Yeah, they're a raw deal, like, where you can drive them, you can work on them, and they've got that look, like, you know, the E30, E36 for sure has that desirable look.
Yeah. Yeah, the Integrale, like, those kind of cars. And that's one of the reasons why I really like the R32 GTR and any of the R33, R34 GTRs, because it's like, those cars, like my R32 GTR has like 440 wheel horse, you know, and it's like that thing is quick, even by today's standards. It's not like Hellcat fast, but it's like it's really quick, you know. So it's like it's one of those cars where it's like, and my car looks pretty much bone stock if you look in the engine bay, you know. I mean, sure, it has HKS intercooler and piping and stuff like that, but everything else looks like bone stock. And I think like those cars. So I think more and more people want cars like that, you know, because another thing, I think people's relationship with cars is going to be totally different. Once things are self-driving, you know, it's like, what I think people will have, like, in the future, I think people will have like some Hyundai that's like self-driving, electric, super comfortable, like pretty sweet, that you're like, damn, I need to go to my office. I hop in, you put that on. You watch The Last of Us on HBO until you get to work, you know? And then at your house, you'll have, like,
your, you know, Carrera 911 that's, you know, your 80, your impact body Carrera, if you're like a car person, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, or you'll have like your E30 or your E36, or you'll have like your whatever, your S2000 or like whatever these kind of cars that people are like, damn, they're cool. It's like last of the fucking visceral and real. And you'll like drive it on the track a couple times a year, and you'll bring it to Cars and Coffee and like rip around your house when the weather's nice. That's kind of how I foresee people, especially with sports cars. I mean, and I think like, you know, for van and overland travel cars, it's like, yeah, those will probably be electric, you know, relatively soon. They're just, electric cars are just so good at doing certain things, but you know, it's like a plastic, it's like, you know, it's like an iPhone. I'd rather have a car that like makes crazy noises and shit, you know? What kind of car did you
completely? Oh man. Well, the family business, like my dad started restoring and buying and selling cars when he was 15, 16 as like a street racer kid. And then has done that ever since. He's 60 this year. So it started really with that, the muscle car stuff, the 60s, because that was, you know, similar to you, like the 90s stuff, you know.
Yeah, for him.
In the 80s, looking back, on that stuff. And so he had always done that stuff. And then when my younger brother and I got into the business when we were young, buying and selling cars, we started to kind of look at it with fresh eyes okay, let's start at, what are the most significant cars in the world, period? What are the most expensive cars in the world, period? And those are the, you know, with a few exceptions, those are the 50s and 60s European sports racing cars. Those are the cars that won Le Mans with Enzo Ferrari and the GT40s and the Shelbys. Yeah. And, you know, so looking at that stuff, that's the stuff that I, and being a race car driver, you know, I had a huge appreciation for those race cars and what those guys were doing.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it started from, you know, looking at what are the most beautiful cars on earth. And so that's always, you know, looking at it, that's up here. And so many of those cars are unobtainable, you know, just looking at them, hoping I can go see them. I got to sit in an SLR coupe, at a car show in Kuwait, and like, you know, there's two of those. That's the most expensive car on the planet. Mercedes brought it over there, and I couldn't believe it was sitting there in the desert, you know, just unattended, and I just hopped in it.
Yeah, they're not making any more of those things.
No. So I mean, that might be the you know, one answer, but again, like I love that Group B shit. Like, come on. That's tough to beat.
Yeah, they're so cool. All those cars. Yeah, the Group B cars are really cool. And it's wild that when they came out, they couldn't, like, no one gave a shit about them, you know?
But it's the same with every car up until very recently, where guys started buying cars and leaving them in the wrapper.
Yeah.
Like that. We've got stories of a guy who bought, he was the owner of the golf racing team after they ran the GT40s, but he bought a 250 Testarossa, you know, an $80 million car today. He bought it in high school, beat the shit out of it, and sold it for like a pittance profit, you know?
Yeah.
There's stories like that all the time.
Oh, yeah, those stories, yeah. There's always stories like that. The person that bought like the 2000, I know someone whose dad bought a 2004 Ford GT and put like 50,000 miles on it and sold it for like nothing, you know, in like 2013. It was like no one cared about it. And now everyone's like, those cars are like, you know, like modern classic.
Totally. And I love those cars. The 05, 06 Ford GT, like,
yeah,
no,
I guess it,
you know,
yeah,
no,
it's so good.
No AIDS.
Yeah, those are such sweet cars. I saw one of those like a year ago, and I was just like, like it's so funny. Like Ferraris do nothing for me. I couldn't care about a Ferrari, and like Porsches, I think Porsches are cool. Like, you know, I would like a 964 Carrera RS. I'm like, all right, damn, that's pretty cool. But like the new shit, like a GT3, whatever. I mean, I get it. I get it that it like is insane on a track, but it's never as good as a race car. You know, that's like what's so funny to me about those cars, you know, where it's like, I get that it's cool that you can drive it on a road, but that thing will get smoked by like a Formula 1000 car, you know? So it's like, what are you trying to do? So the, like the supercars doesn't appeal to me as much, but like the, like cars, like, you know, a Lancia Stratos or something like that. I'm like, all right. I'm like,
oh
yeah. I'm like, all right. Those are fucking insanely cool. You know? So like any, yeah, those are just kind of like the cars that I would love to have, but I would never fit. I couldn't fit in the Stratos, but like, or a Dino, a Ferrari, Ferrari Dinos. Now we're talking, you know, but like the new stuff, I'm like, wow, people, that whole culture of like those people, like buying every Ferrari so that they can get like the limited one. I'm just like, this is some like rich guy energy that I could never fathom. And they never drive any of them. It's just so perplexing to me. You know, I'm like, what? You don't drive these things? You've never taken one of these things on the track? Like, what are you doing? But it, and it's like, but that's the thing, like within cars, there's all sorts of different people, you know, that like, it speaks to everyone differently.
For sure, for sure. And like, I think that's what I loved growing up in this industry is, you know, they're, you know, I obviously like able to hang out with those guys who buy every single Ferrari new, but at the same time can equally talk to the guy at the Saturday night dirt track, you know, who's wrenching in his one car garage. And it's a great equalizer, I think, as far as as far as social status and cultural status,
definitely,
and economic status.
I mean, the cars are a universal thing.
For sure. For sure. Man, before I let you go, I really appreciate you taking the time, but I think a lot of people who do follow you or know who you are would probably appreciate some advice as far as, you know, what would be your, what they should have as their kind of guiding North Star as far as their creativity or what to do. Like, it seems like you really follow your own path, and it's, and everything seems to work out.
I would say, like, to me, I think social media is kind of death knell for creativity because people are always comparing themselves to others and also comparing a project or an idea that's maybe partially incubated to one that's fully incubated. So it's like, oh, this didn't get any likes, therefore it's not real. And it's like, when I started doing van life, no one gave a shit about it. It took years for people to be like, this is a thing, you know? And I think there's lots of stuff like that, you know, where it's like history is, you know, you really just, I think it's the most important thing is for you to be really believe in what you're doing and kind of create on an island and then go share it with the world. And like one thing I always, I'm like, won't shut up about talking with friends is how influential Jamaica on music, where it's like, it's an island of a million people, but from Jamaican music, you can trace rap, electronic music, reggae, like all of this music originated from this one place where there's not a lot of people there.
Yeah, ska punk. Yeah.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah.
You know, EDM pretty much, like from dub. And it's like, well, and my theory is it happened like that because creative people just kind of made shit that they were into and then it like spiraled out of control. And if you try to like, you got to like fully commit to the spiral in order for it to work, you know? Whereas like, if you like, oh, here's this new idea I have. Oh, no one liked it. I'm not going to do any more of it. You know, like, no. That's wrong. Like kind of, if you really feel passionate about something, just keep doing it and don't be concerned that it isn't immediately accepted and liked by a shitload of people, you know? Like that is not what it's about. And like the most successful stuff I've done has never really been immediately like, that's awesome, you know? It always kind of takes a little time for not only for audiences to mature, but also for you to figure out and find your stride as an artist, you know? So yeah, that's what I would say.
Oh, that's good. Do you think something to do with people being able to smell, you know, the intention or the inauthenticity a mile away, you know, whereas if you're really all in,
that definitely has something to do with it too. Yeah, like people can tell if some shit is sideshow, you know, but if you're like fully into it and believe it, then people really appreciate that more.
So. Yeah. No. Anything else to share? Any you wanted to mention? I don't know if your new movie's out yet, or like if you've announced it, or anything
no,
like
I mean,
that.
I have it really.
Share on here?
Not really. Okay. Maybe sometime I'll hit you up, be like, you know, come have me back on. But I mean, yeah. I mean, I think 80s and 90s cars are cool. They drive great.
Yeah.
They're still fun. Get them while they're cheap. Because modern cars suck to own. Like, I think right now, like, everyone's like, dude, now it's like the golden age of the ICE engines. It's like, you can get a Hellcat with a trillion horsepower. And I'm like, all right, good luck maintaining that thing in 20 years when it's like an electrical clusterfuck, you know? Especially
yeah.
like all these cars that are super fast because of electronic aids. It's like, oh, dude, what? Good luck when your TPS sensor wears out and you can't find one, or your center diff freaking temperature reading sensor doesn't talk to your ECU, and like your fucking rain comes down through your sunroof and nukes some sensor and your car's dead. Like, that's what's going to happen with all these cars in 20 years, you know? And no one's going to, and like none of these car companies are going to support them, because they're going to be like making fucking spaceships and shit, you know? So.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's, man, that's a good way to end this off. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, dude. Good talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. I'd be really stoked to do it again in a year or two, or whenever you want.
Likewise, man. Let's be in touch.
Yeah, take care.
All right, later.
I'm going to leave you guys with a quote from Terrence McKenna that is very fitting for this podcast. We have to create culture. Don't watch TV. Don't read magazines. Don't even listen to NPR. Create your own roadshow. The nexus of space and time where you are now is the most immediate sector of your universe. And if you're worrying about Michael Jackson or Bill Clinton or somebody else, then you're disempowered. You're giving it all away to icons. Icons which are maintained by an electronic media, so that you want to dress like X or have lips like Y. This is shit-brained, this kind of thinking. That is all cultural diversion. And what is real is you and your friends and your associations, your highs, your hopes, your plans, your fears. And we are told, no, we're unimportant. You're peripheral. Get a degree. Get a job. Get a this, get a that. And then you're a player. Well, you don't even want to play in that game. You want to reclaim your mind and get it out of the hands of the cultural engineers who want to turn you into a half-baked moron consuming all this trash that's being manufactured out of the bones of a dying planet. See you guys next week.